Jarne Nirvasesis and Nivani Vaskajadis Dharani. Vandeham Sri Guru Sri Cha Parakamam Sri Gurum Vaishnavamscha Sri Rupam Sagujatam Sahagana Raghunatham Vitamastam Sajivam Sadvoitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Devam Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamascha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Sorry, I got knocked off. I'm back on again. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. October 11th, 2011, first day of Kartik, Hilo, Hawaii, Sky Class, reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Dhritarashtra quits home, Chapter 13, Text 5. Prati, toward Ujjagmuhu, went, Braharshena, with great delight, pranam, life, tanvaha, of the body, eva, like, agatam, returned, abhisangamya, approaching, vidivat, in due form, parisvanga, embracing, abhivadanai, by obeisances. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. With great delight, they all approached him. As if life had returned to their bodies, they exchanged obeisances and welcomed each other with embraces. So to put this in context, this is Vidura. He went on pilgrimage because of being insulted by Duryodhana. Threatened, not just insulted, but threatened. Duryodhana said, throw him out with only his breath. So he thought, better to leave on my own. Right? Like if you know you're going to be fired, you resign. So he left on his own, traveled, went on pilgrimage, basically took up the Vanaprastha order, met Uddhava and Maitreya, got spiritual knowledge from Maitreya, battle of Kurukshetra is over, and he comes back to Hastinapur, and as we read in the previous verse, the people who greeted him were Maharaj Yudhisthira, his brothers, Dhritarashtra, Satyaki, Sanjaya, Kripacharya, Kunti, Gandhari, Draupadi, Subhadra, Uttara, Kripi, many other wives of the Kauravas, other ladies with children, etc. So I'm going to read this verse again, read the purport then. With great delight, they all approached him as if life had returned to their bodies. They exchanged obeisances and welcomed each other with embraces. Purport. In the absence of consciousness, the limbs of the body remain inactive. But when consciousness returns, the limbs and senses become active, and existence itself becomes delightful. Vidura was so dear to the members of the Kaurava family that his long absence from the palace was comparable to inactivity. All of them were feeling acute separation from Vidura, and therefore his return to the palace was joyful for all. Pratyujyagmuhu praharshena pranam tanva ivagatam abhishangam yavidivat parishvanga bivadanaiha. With great delight they all approached him, as if life had returned to their bodies. They exchanged obeisances and welcomed each other with embraces. So we've talked a lot in the last few weeks or months about the external opulences of a Krishna-conscious society. Talked about Maharaj Yudhisthira, Maharaj Parikshit, how under their reign things were so opulent in terms of the externals, food, clothing, shelter, that there were heaps of gold lying around for decades or centuries, and nobody even touched it, nobody needed it, nobody was interested in it. And here we're seeing another opulence, emotional opulence, social and emotional. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about three levels of rasa: gross physical rasa, subtle, what he calls heavenly, swarga rasa, and spiritual rasa. Srila Prabhupada very nicely explains that whatever taste we're experiencing, rasoham apsukanteya, we usually say that's the taste in water, but really the taste of anything is Krishna. Ultimately, whatever rasa we're enjoying, that is Krishna. Krishna's the healing power of the herbs, the fragrance of the earth, the light of the sun. And the ultimate rasas, the five primary rasas: neutrality, servant, friend, parental, lover. The secondary rasas, chivalry, ghastliness, humor, etc. That's really all there is. I was just reading that recently. Prabhupada said that's all there is. And the perversions of those, really, we're having that relationship with Krishna, but the perversions of those become our emotional, material emotional relationships and our material physiological relationships. So this is what we're looking for. We're looking for this rasa, this taste, this pleasure. That's our motivation for action. That's why we do things. Prabhupada very nicely explained this in the introduction to the Nectar of Devotion. Everything we do is to achieve some taste, some flavor. And we want varieties of flavor. Although we talk about, we call Krishna's ultimate rasa, the conjugal rasa or Sringar rasa, as the Madhurya rasa, the sweet rasa. Nobody wants to eat only sweets. And we want a variety of tastes. Variety is the mother of enjoyment. So we're looking for all different sorts of tastes in our relationships and in our physiological activities. So the gross external opulences that have already been discussed, the opulences of having nice clothing, silk clothing, cotton clothing, beautiful clothing, stuff that's nice to the skin, healthy for the body, beautiful for the eye, attractive homes that are comfortable in different seasons, again, that are attractive, that are functional, protect one from the elements, good food, actual food that nourishes the body, gives different taste to the tongue, satisfaction to the belly, strength and health, and energy to the body, suitable occupations that are satisfying to the mind, that are suitable for the person, weather that's not too hot or too cold, entertainment that's in relationship to Krishna, that relieves one from material anxiety and connects one to the Supreme. Those are all on the platform of the gross senses. Pleasant things to hear, to taste, to touch, to smell. But that's not the only kind of rasa we're interested in. We're also interested in emotional rasa. And it's interesting that Bhaktivinoda Thakur calls this as heavenly rasa. We see, in fact, on this earth planet, that even if you're able to get the gross opulences together, it's usually hard to get the subtle opulences together. Especially in this Kali Yuga. Kali Yuga is the age of quarrel and hypocrisy. And there is quarreling even between intimate family members. This is discussed in the Bhagavatam with amazement. Even between husband and wife, there's quarrels. So we can understand that formerly, quarrels between husband and wife were very unusual. Of course, they were there, just like Sati, rather, has a quarrel with Shiva about whether or not she should attend her father's sacrifice, and ends up leading to her leaving her body. And Prabhupada says in that purport that there's room for misunderstanding between husband and wife, even on the highest levels, but not like today, where half of all marriages end in divorce, and we can assume that of the half that doesn't end in divorce, that not all of them are happy. We have some neighbors across the street here who like to take their marital fights into the street. They're not content to have them in their living room. So sometimes we hear them yelling and screaming and swearing at each other right on the street. So people in this present time, they're not experiencing the gross opulences. Our so-called food is genetically engineered, ripened with chemicals, grown with chemicals, bred for being able to be shipped long distance without getting bruised, rather than bred for nutrition and taste. And we go on and on. Our jewelry is made of plastic, or artificially created gemstones, which don't have any healing effect on the body. Our clothes are made out of petroleum, and so forth and so on. So on the level of gross rasa, we're not getting proper satisfaction. What we have in most of the world is insufficient. Some parts of the world, like America, most people have more than sufficient. But for most people in the world, insufficient gross sense gratification. And the sense gratification is not healthy. It's damaging. Entertainment is damaging. The food is damaging. The clothing is damaging. The building materials and the homes are putting out toxic fumes and so forth. And at the level of subtle rasa, also disturbing. Misunderstanding, hypocrisy, cheating, lying, fighting, and dissatisfaction. How many people would say, yes, I have a really good understanding with my husband or my wife, or I have a really good understanding with my children? I mean, do we have a society where we have people we can confide in and who understand our heart? You know, in the higher planets, they can even communicate without speech. They have such a rasa of love and exchange that they can have this connection with each other. So we see this in this verse today. What kind of connection these great devotees had with each other? Of course, their connection is above the level of swarga. Their connection is because they are all pure devotees. And sometimes people ask, actually it's a question we get quite a bit, that do pure devotees in the spiritual world have relationships with each other? Because we hear only Krishna, only Krishna. In fact, the definition of prema is that Krishna is the only object of affection. Like Queen Kunti's prayer, she says, it's like the Ganges goes to the sea. Let my attention be drawn to you without being diverted to anyone else. And Bhishma says the definition of prema is when Krishna is the only object of kinship. Bhaktivinoda Thakur says like this too, Janaka Janani Daita Tanai Prabhu Guru Patituhu Sarvamoy. You are my mother, you are my father, you are my lover, you are my son, you are my guru, you are everything to me. He has other songs where he gives a little different list, but similar idea, you're my brother. Whatever relationships there are, you are everything. So people think, well, I have everything with Krishna, that means I have no relationship with anyone else. But here we see, at many places, but here we see, particularly in today's verse, how the pure devotees in Hastinapur, not even just the pure devotees, even people like Dhritarashtra and Gandhari, who were certainly not, at least at this time, pure devotees, they felt that without Vidura, it was as if they were unconscious, as if the whole palace were unconscious, as if there was no life. And when he came back, it was like coming back to life, like waking up after surgery and finding that you're still alive. coming back after some disease where you practically died. So we are looking for this sort of society. In fact, you can say that the definition of fruit of work, the fruit that one wants, the karma pala that one wants, is this rasa. We want it on the gross platform, and we want it on the subtle platform. And if you're at all a human being, you want it on the subtle platform also. And frankly, even among the animals, they want some rasa on the subtle platform. Even among the animals, there's only a few kinds of animals that have no emotional connection with others of their own species even. That's unusual. We see even among, Prabhupada talks about this also in Introduction to Nectar Devotion, that there's love even among the tigers. And you see the tigers mating and they're affectionate to each other. Or the mother tiger, the tigress, she's affectionate to her cubs. Or the great bond of affection among the elephant society or the ostrich society. Even among the seahorses, where the father seahorse very diligently carries the eggs around and protects them. How the mother bird will pretend to be injured to lure the predator away from the eggs, even at the risk of her own life. So there's affection even among the animal society. And anyone who works with animals sees that the animals have affection and they want some emotional exchange. If you're around cows and horses, they want to be petted, not just because they like the sensation of being scratched. I mean, when you take care of cows, you give them a scratching post. But if there's a human to scratch them, they'll prefer that because they want the affection. They want the loving exchange. I think I've told the story before how we used to have some pet ducks out in our yard to eat the slugs. They were very good at eating the slugs. And although it was the children and I who took care of the ducks, my husband didn't take care of the ducks at all, when he would drive home from work, when as soon as his vehicle was within earshot, the ducks would get all excited and they would waddle over to the gate, quack, 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 and greet him. So even the ducks, they were having some emotional exchange with their human masters, desiring. So this is what we're looking for. All of our actions are looking for this rasa, grossly physical and emotional, social. Of course, the problem is that when one tries to get this rasa, which is really just Krishna, it is nothing but Krishna. But when one tries to get this rasa separately from Krishna, you really don't end up with very much. Anything that appears to be of value, if without relation to me, has no reality. Know it to be my illusory energy, that reflection which appears to be in darkness. So the example that Srila Prabhupada gives is that of the hand trying to rub food into itself. Maybe a little bit goes through the skin, I don't know. They are able to put medicines and patches on the skin instead of through the mouth. But how much nutritional value are you going to get just rubbing food on your hand? Not very much. You're not going to be able to live that way. You have to put food into the mouth. It has to go into the stomach. And if the hand thinks, let me become independent, let me cut myself off from the body, then it simply withers. So material life is like that. I'm looking for Krishna, I'm looking for rasa. But because I'm trying to look for it separately from Krishna, I don't get much. The comparison is a drop of water in the desert. That's the comparison. So if you're really thirsty and somebody puts an eyedropper, you know, of water on your tongue, you can say it's water, but it, you know, you're not satisfied. It's not very meaningful. And that's true even if one has perfect physical and emotional social situation. Even if one can go to the heavenly planets where the physical situation is thousands and thousands of times better than anything we can imagine on Earth, even Hawaii or Tahiti. The quality of the food, the clothing, the residences, these are all nicely described in the Bhagavatam. The colors, the sounds, they're practically beyond imagination for an earthly person. And the same with the social and emotional relationships. People's dealings are, from a human point of view, without lust and envy. People get along. They're kind to each other. They're respectful to each other. They're appreciative of each other. Again, not by Kunta standards, but by Earth standards. From the point of view of an earthling, there's basically no lust, anger, envy, or greed in Swarga. And therefore, our activities, they're aimed like that. Karma pala, that's the fruit we want. Either we're trying to establish heaven on earth, which of course in Kali Yuga materially isn't going to happen. You know, we're trying to establish heaven on earth through science and technology, or through going back to the land and doing organic gardening, depending on what where your faith is. Krishna talks about in the 17th chapter, one has faith in the different modes. So according to one's faith, one may be trying to establish heaven on earth through, you know, relationship seminars, or through growing your own food, or through the best new kind of antibiotic in heart surgery, or whatever it may be, through political maneuverations. Or one may be looking to go to a material heaven. So the goal of most of the religionists on the planets, probably the planets too, doesn't matter whether they call themselves Christians or Hindus or Jews or Buddhists, most of them want to go to heaven. Most of them want to go to heaven. Some of them are focused on having a heaven on earth. The Jehovah's Witnesses are like that. But most are focused on going to another kind of heaven on another sphere after they die. So two kinds of karmapala, wanting your life on earth to be like heaven and wanting after you die to go to heaven. And if you can get both, well, so much the better. But an intelligent person can understand that this isn't going to work. That even if I have the most heavenly material situation, because I'm still imagining that I'm disconnected with Krishna and putting myself at the center, I'm not going to experience the rasa that I want. I'm just not. No matter how wonderful the taste of something is, pouring it over my hand is going to give me a very limited, unsatisfying experience. It's just not the way to do it. Or putting the, you know, milkshake up my nose. I'm just simply not going to become fully satisfied with that, no matter how wonderful it is. It's just not the way to do it. And ultimately, it's not touching me, the soul. Now, here it's explained in the purport. We are different from this body. I'm different from this body. And I'm different from the mind. Mamai vamso jiva loke jiva bhuta sanatana. Manasastra nindriyani prakriti stani karshati. I'm struggling karshati with the indriyani, the senses, and with the mind. I'm not even the mind. So even if I get this relationship emotionally and socially perfect, If I could have the perfect situation for my senses and the perfect situation for my mind, my emotions, my social interactions. And that exists on the upper planets. The higher you go in the material world, in the planetary systems, the more and more perfect the situation of bodily, mental, emotional sense gratification you have. And on the planets of the rishis, they're gotten to the point where all their sense gratification is all mental and emotional. They don't even need the physical body. But Abrahma Bhuvana Loka Punarvarti Arjuna Mamupecha Tukanteya Punajanma Navijite. Even at Brahma's planet, it's still not ultimately satisfying because it doesn't touch the self. No matter how fancy the bird cage, if you're not feeding the bird, it just doesn't work. So when we try to make ourself the center, when I'm thinking ultimately about pleasing me, and I try to have relationships with material objects and with other living entities, with me as the center, it just doesn't work because I'm not the center. I'm just not the center. I mean, a little bit of thought will bring us to the understanding that I'm not the center. And recently, our godbrother Gopi Pranadana Prabhu left this world. So those of us who knew him, or knew him well, we have some grief. We wonder how the service he was doing is going to go on. Next time we're in Govardhan, we'll be sad that we cannot go and visit him. But other than a few people like his wife and his son, and his very close students, most of us are not finding that our lives are really disrupted. So he couldn't have been the center of the universe. And this is true for everyone. You know, when we die, our friends and relatives will come to our funeral if they're in town. Maybe some of them will fly in. There might be some disruption for a little while for our family members who have to go through our belongings. And if we have accumulated a lot, then they may be disrupted for a while. We may have to worry about selling our house, selling our car. And then their life will go on. The whole world will go on. We'll hardly be a blip. We may not even get, you know, more than a line in the newspaper. And life will go on practically as if we were never here. So how could we be the center? Just like the scientists talk about the sun as the center of the solar system. You know, the sun drops out, there's all life is going to stop. But if some little asteroid, you know, burns up in the Earth's atmosphere, who cares for it? What to speak of a speck of space dust? I mean, if we want to know how insignificant we are, just, you know, be sick for a while and you see life goes on. Even the people who depend on us, somehow or other they go on. They eat, they get clean clothes. So who are we? If we were the center, then as soon as we were out of commission, just like Lord Brahma, when Lord Brahma takes a little nap, there's a partial devastation in the universe. You know, when I take a nap, I mean, what happens? Not much. Maybe the little kid puts baby powder on the floor or something. You know, I'm not the center. Everything doesn't revolve around me. And any rasa I'm trying to have with myself at the center, thinking on the body and mind, is false. So how do these devotees do it here in Hastinapur? So they're doing it the right way. Now, interestingly enough, the right way also starts with looking at my own self. So the wrong way starts with looking at my own self, saying, I'm the most important, I'm the center, I am the body and the mind. As soon as one thinks that one's the center, one has to get a material body and mind. Because you can only be the center in illusion. You have to have an illusory vehicle. But if I look at my own self, actually look at myself, and actually see who I am, then I can come to the rasa that I want. On every level. On every level. So we know when Krishna was manifest on earth, Lord Brahma was watching his pastimes, particularly the killing of Agasura, and he was astonished at a number of things. He was astonished how Agasura, whose body Krishna entered, attained a Vaikuntha form. And he saw this Vaikuntha form of the entity that had been Agasura going to the spiritual world in a Vaikuntha airplane past his abode. So he was pretty amazed about that because he knew that Agasura, Aga means sinful, Asura means demon, that this sinful demon would not normally go to Vaikuntha. When he goes to go check out what's happening here, he sees Krishna eating with the cowherd boys. Now, he had been thinking that Krishna was his master, Narayana, but that's not how Narayana eats. Narayana eats in grand style with the offerings made according to the Vedic regulations. Or he eats the offerings and the fire sacrifice. He doesn't just sit down and have a picnic with other boys as if they're equals. And the cowherd boys were not going through some ceremony to offer food to Krishna. They were just saying, hey, Krishna, try this. And they were even doing things like taking the vegetables out of the samosas and stuffing the samosas with flowers and giving it to Krishna and to their friends and stealing each other's lunches. And, you know, Krishna's mother, because she's the queen of Vrindavan, she packs a really nice lunch for Krishna. But some of the cowherd boys get a pretty simple lunch. And Krishna would switch, and he'd give his nice food to the cowherd boys, and he would eat their simple food. So Lord Brahma's looking at this. Oh, and Krishna was also eating with his left hand, right? He had food in his left hand. We know that by Vedic standards, you only eat with your right hand. Well, so many things that by the standards that Lord Brahma's used to were really irregular. And he's thinking, okay, so this boy Krishna not just liberated Agasura, but sent him to Vaikuntha, and here he's just eating with these cowherd boys, you know, with flowers and the samosas, and eating with his left hand, and, you know, what's going on here? So he thought, all right, let's see who he really is. And he stole the cowherd boys and the calves. Then Krishna manifested identical, not fully identical, because they weren't another set of jivas. You can only one jiva. There's only one of each jiva. You can't manifest an identical jiva. But he manifested Vishnu forms that appeared to be identical not only in appearance, but also in personality and in their relationships. Of course, as I said, they weren't exactly identical. Their relationships with everyone were a little different. Their relationships with everyone was the kind of relationships Krishna had, not the kind of relationships they originally had. The love between the residents of Vrindavan and these so-called identical forms was like the love the residents had with Krishna. And they didn't talk about Krishna. They didn't come home and say, guess what Krishna did today, like they usually did. Anyway, then later Brahma came back and he couldn't understand what was going on because he knows there's only one of each jiva. And he was very bewildered. Krishna showed him that everyone was a Vishnu form, and so forth. Then Maharishi Brihat asks at the end of this lila, he says, how is it that the residents of Vrindavan had more love for Krishna in the form of their children than they had for their actual children? He said, this doesn't make any sense to him. I mean, we see that pretty much universally, people love their own children more than they love other people's children. It's pretty much universal. Very, very difficult to love somebody else's children as much as your own child. What to speak of more than your own child? It happens, obviously, but it's unusual. Our attachment to our own children is very strong. In fact, in the animal society, attachment to children is much stronger than the attachment to a mate. Much stronger. To protect the children. So Shukadeva Goswami explains that our ultimate attachment is to ourself. That's our ultimate attachment. One father told me the story how he took his son out to play ping pong, table tennis, And when they went to the table tennis place, there was a table that was folded up. So he and his son were unfolding the table, and it didn't do it properly. It started to fall. It ended up falling on the boy's knee, and it was a minor injury. And I asked the father, you know, what did you do when it started falling? He said, oh, I just ran and got out of the way. So our first inclination is for ourselves, even when it comes to our children, our near and dear ones. Of course, sometimes people will sacrifice themselves for their children and their etc., but we consider that heroism. Some soldier who picks up the live grenade and throws it to save his buddies and in the process gets his hand blown off, you know, they get a Medal of Honor. Because that's unusual behavior, beyond what's expected. We expect that people are ultimately going to take care of themselves. That's who we love the most. And we see that, especially in modern society, people don't think much of rejecting their spouse or even rejecting their children, rejecting their mother and father for themselves. I mean, look at abortion. People have abortion because they value themselves over their child, even to the point of killing their child. You know, there's now this thing that if a woman's pregnant with twins and she thinks, oh, taking care of twins is too much trouble, she goes and gets a pregnancy reduction where the doctor kills one of the twins. Oh, I don't think I can take care of two babies. So she's thinking about herself. Now, those are very extreme examples. But the fact is that the person we love the most is ourself. And Sukadeva Goswami says, why do we love ourselves? There's also the self of the self. Kshetra Jamachapi Mam Vidhi, Sarva Kshetra Shubharta, Kshetra Kshetra Gyo Yanam, Yat Tejkyana Matam Mama. Krishna is actually the self of the self, the super self, the Param Atma. So, who's really most dear to us is the self of the self. That's our ultimate dear object. So this self of the self is more dear to us than ourself. What to speak of being more dear to us than our material byproducts, like family. So when a person develops affection for the self of the self directly, what happens? Right? We saw what happens when I put myself at the center artificially. But if I really go to the center, if I really go to myself, as Krishna explains in the sixth chapter of Bhagavad Gita, that one in yogic trance relishes and rejoices in the self. If I go deep in the self, who's in the heart of the self? The Paramatma, which includes me. He includes me. Again, if I put food in the stomach, that includes the hands. It's not something separate. The hand in its natural position is not most devoted to itself directly. It's most devoted to itself indirectly through the stomach. Now, something amazing happens when I put all of my affection, 110%, into the self of the self. Very interesting. Because if I put all of my affection into myself directly, it's just chaos and disappointment. Because I'm not the center. I end up being the center in illusion, therefore all of my relationships are illusory and unsatisfying. But when I go to the real self, and I go to the heart of the real self, and I find the actual center of myself, and I put all of my love and affection and service, every bit of it, not one speck left for anyone or anything else than the self of my very self. When I do something that appears to be the height of selfishness, what happens? Suridam sarvadehina. I end up loving everyone, and I become the best friend of everyone. Why? Because when I go to the core of myself and find in the heart of myself the Lord, well, he's also the heart of everyone else's self. So as soon as all of my love is at the root, then naturally I love the whole tree that comes from the root. If I put food in the stomach, if my hand puts food in the stomach, then my hand also loves my nose. If my hand is focused only on itself, what kind of relationship can it have with the nose and with the feet? When the hand has a relationship with the stomach and putting food into the stomach, then the hand is also caring for all the other parts of the body. Therefore, these devotees, Uttara, Subhadra, Draupadi, Yudhishthira, who've given all of their love to Krishna, every bit of it, they love Vidura. They love Vidura so much that when he's gone, they feel like they're dead. They're unconscious. And when he comes back, they feel like they've come to life. They feel like he is the soul of their bodies. Interesting, because Krishna is the soul of their bodies. This is nicely explained, I believe, by the gopis, where they say, Krishna, without, as soon as you leave the body becomes useless. You are the real husband. You are the real everything. And how interesting that when one sees Krishna like that, one also sees the devotees like that. And therefore, what we desire in terms of heavenly rasa, of emotional social interaction, what we desire in terms of physiological rasa, nice food, nice clothes, nice weather, that's all included. When you go to the source, everything you want is included. And when you try to go to things separately, you don't really get very much. And the more and more society becomes separated from Krishna, the less and less and less society has of this emotional and physiological satisfaction. So we see modern society, the modern secular society, where there's just chaos on both the level of physiological and psychological rasa. People are not satisfied in general on either of these levels. So a society where Krishna is the center becomes a society that has normal situations, not just with food and water, but with social and emotional interactions. And it's interesting in the Nectar of Instruction, where Rupa Goswami discusses the six loving exchanges between the devotees, that Prabhupada says the purpose of our international society is to nurture these loving relationships. Prabhupada envisioned a society that was like a family with a culture of love and trust, not a culture of bureaucracy or rules and regulations. Prabhupada said, Bhaktisiddhanta said, as soon as you have bureaucracy, everything's finished, then it becomes a mechanical arrangement. That isn't the way that Krishna consciousness becomes a pleasing society. But you must have Krishna first. If you first try to take care of the physical things and the social emotional things, it doesn't work. It's got to come from the root. Of course, part of going to the root is setting up the physical and emotional situation to facilitate going to the root. So part of going to the root of Krishna is to offer nice food to Krishna. But the satisfaction that I'm going to get from my food only comes when Krishna's at the root, when Krishna's at the center. What does this mean practically, putting Krishna at the center? Well, there's a direct and indirect way. The direct way to put Krishna at the center, this is from 12th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, is to be in samadhi, to have one's, ultimately, to be functioning at the spiritual level, where one is not really in the world at all. One is living in Krishna. A little lower than that is one's mind and intelligence are fixed in Krishna. One is constantly meditating on Krishna's name, form, qualities, and pastimes. If one cannot do that, one does abhyas yoga. One keeps repeating again and again from wherever and wherever the mind wanders due to its flickering and unsteady nature. One must certainly withdraw it and put it on the self. This is called sadhana bhakti. Sadhana bhakti, practice bhakti, abhyas yoga, repetition. I keep thinking about Krishna. I keep thinking about Krishna, Krishna's name, Krishna's form, Krishna's qualities, Krishna's pastimes. I'm absorbing my mind in Krishna. That is sadhana bhakti. If one cannot do that, then one engages just the external body in the angas of bhakti. One plants flowers, one bathes the deities, one distributes books, one builds temples, we give our money to Krishna. We're not really thinking about Krishna. Maybe we think of Krishna, you know, 5 minutes a day. But we're using our body in the angas of bhakti. We're using our bodies in the angas of bhakti. And we have as a goal, our goal is, I want to attain to Goloka Vrindavan. We basically offer everything to Krishna, yat kiroshi, yat agnasi, yat tahoshi, yat tapasasi kante, yat tatguru shramadarpana. We offer everything to Krishna with the consciousness that whatever material enjoyment we get is Krishna's prasadam. It's very nicely explained in the last five verses of the Brahma Samhita, especially, I think, 61, by Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati. That's also nicely explained in the story of Sudama Brahmana, that one gives everything to Krishna, and whatever one gets, like you may build a temple for Krishna, and of course you might live there also. You offer food to Krishna, and you get to eat the food also. You sing nice music for Krishna, and you get to hear the music also. You develop a society with sweet relationships for Krishna, and you get to enjoy those sweet relationships as prasadam. So that's three levels. The bottom level is I'm basically just engaging my body in the angas of bhakti with the purpose of pleasing Krishna, and I do my best to think of Krishna when I can. The next level is the actual level of sadhana bhakti or abhyas yoga. The sadhana I'm doing in sadhana bhakti is that in the course of using my body in Krishna's service, I'm constantly pulling my mind back to think of Krishna, and the top level is where my mind is absorbed in Krishna. And that is the way to make Krishna as a center. Now, if somebody is not able to do that, if they're not willing to engage their body in the angas of bhakti, what to speak of if they think it's too hard to engage their mind in Krishna, there's also an indirect process. Indirect process is where one engages in varnashram dharma, in one's duties, one's ordinary, desired, and emergency duties, not exactly for the sake of pleasing Krishna, not exactly for the goal of pleasing Krishna, but giving up this goal of swarga, karma palatyaga. One gives up this goal of heaven, either on earth or on another planet. One stops trying to enjoy separately. And one does one's karma as yajna, karma yoga. What is the goal of one's activity? If the goal of one's activity is not to please Krishna, at least the goal of one's activity is self-purification. At least one wants purification. Basically, one wants liberation. One is working for liberation. So whatever one is working, not to get sweet relationships in this world, not to have a pleasing physical situation. One is working just because the work should be done, as a sacrifice for the Supreme, without really understanding much of whom the Supreme is, and with focus on the self, to purify the self. And working like that, as soon as one works with, it's interesting, Prahlad Maharaj says this, fascinating. He says, as long as one is looking for happiness, one doesn't find it, and as soon as one gives up looking for happiness, then one becomes happy. So Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita 12:12, that as soon as one renounces this desire for material heavenly pleasure, one attains peace. As soon as one's working like that, as soon as one is thinking, I'm doing my work just for purification, one becomes peaceful. Then from the platform of peace, one can study the Upanishads, and one can understand, I'm not this body. There's an ultimate reality. Then with that understanding, one meditates on the self, or one meditates on Brahman, or the Paramatma. From that meditation, one gives up all material affinity, and from that point, then one focuses one's mind upon Krishna. One comes to Abhyas Yoga or Sadhana Bhakti. So that's the indirect method, which is not recommended by Krishna. Klesho Dikataraste Sam Avyakta Shakti Tejasam Avyakta Higatir Dukam Dehavadvir Avapyate. This is a very difficult method just to work for one's own purification and liberation. Better to take the direct method where one engages one's physical senses in the angas of bhakti with the goal of pleasing Krishna, not with the goal of heavenly enjoyment, and where one does one's best to keep drawing one's mind back to Krishna over and over again, even though the mind is like some big Ganges river or, you know, Chanchala Himana Krishna, this flickering wind. And as one does this, then one will find that one gets all of these heavenly delights that one could desire. We see that when people are fixed in Krishna, even if other people don't treat them nicely, even if they don't get good food to eat or nice clothes to wear, they're experiencing all the pleasure from sweet relationships and from physical sense gratification. More than is available in heaven, because they're connected with the source of all rasa. So we're all working for rasa. Let's go to the reservoir. What does Krishna tell Arjuna? Anything you can get from all different wells, you can get from one reservoir of rasa. The reservoir of pleasure. We have that little booklet Prabhupada printed. Krishna, the reservoir of pleasure. We don't want to drop. We want the ocean. Go to the ocean. Go to the reservoir. When we go to the reservoir, everything we want will be included. We will not be dependent on the externals in order to get the rasa we want. That will be within. We will not be dependent on how other people treat me in order to get the relationships I want with other people. We will not be dependent on the external situation for the body in order to get sense pleasure for the body. Inconceivable for a conditioned soul. Because we'll be going to the source. And where is the source? Ishvara Sarvabhutanam Hridayesh Arjuna Tisthati. It's in me. I've got it. I'm not dependent on anyone else. I already have it. And if we have a society where people in general are going to the source, are going to Krishna, then even externally it will be like what's described here in the Bhagavatam. This is the type of society we hope to create, better than what's described here, because what's described here, of course, is at the beginning of Kali Yuga. Brahma says that in this golden age of Mahaprabhu, we can restore the situation of such a yuga. But whether or not we are living on this planet when such gets done externally, whatever role we may play in that, we can be experiencing that on an internal level if we really make Krishna the center. Not just by our external actions, but by our internal focus. So thank you very much. I have some questions, comments, corrections, chastisements.
Everybody in pre-conferencing. Anyone has any questions or comments? I can
ask you
a question right off the bat.
Sure.
Yes, you were speaking that animals also, they have this need for an exchange of rasa. That makes perfect sense to me. In my own experience as well, and everybody else's. However, in the third verse, in the purport of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Srila Prabhupada says, there is no possibility of an exchange or rasa between a man and and an animal or between a man and any other species of living beings within the material world. The rasas are exchanged between members of the same species. Could you explain that? I never really understood this statement.
I would say that even between members of the same species, we're only experiencing an exchange that's a parody or a reflection of rasa. And the further that you get from oneness, the less able to have an actual exchange. You know, an exchange of rasa requires simultaneous oneness and difference. If you're completely different, how can you exchange anything? You don't understand each other. You ever try having an exchange with somebody whose thinking process is radically different from yours? You know, even if you're using the same words, you don't mean the same thing. And it's just very frustrating. You know, if someone's perspective is just completely different from yours, and if you're just incapable of seeing their perspective and they're incapable of seeing your perspective, all you end up with is frustration. There has to be some oneness there. So the further away you get from that, the less you are able to experience rasa. So I understand it that way. I didn't take that statement that Prabhupada made as an absolute statement. Although he tends to put it in absolute terms in that purport, I don't take it as absolute. I take it as a continuum. You know, the less you share with somebody, the less you're able to have any kind of meaningful exchange. But even among humans, I mean, among conditioned souls, how much rasa can you really have? It's pretty limited. You know, when you're having your exchange with your dog, your dog's interpretation of the exchange and your interpretation of the exchange are so different that it's almost like it's not really an exchange going on. You know, you're projecting what your dog thinks about you and what your dog's motives are. And the dog doesn't really understand you. So it's actually very minimal. This happens even between humans, where there are some humans that, you know, just on a material level, that I think each of us would have to say we just can't connect with at all, or very little. You know, I've met other humans that I'm just, you know, I can connect with them spiritually, but materially, I'm just, forget it. I can't even have a conversation with them. Because our thinking is so different and our perspectives are so different, there's just no place to connect. It's kind of like, you know, when you travel, I don't know why it's like this, but electrical outlets, in other parts of the world, they call them power points. they'll say you have to plug it into the power point. I'll be like, huh? But the electrical outlets, you know, the little boxes in the walls where you plug... I'm always thinking how people are listening to this in different parts of the world. The place where you stick your electrical plug into, they're different. So they have different sizes and shapes of receptacles in the wall. And you have to have the right kind of plug in order to plug your computer into it. It just won't fit otherwise. So to have a connection, there has to be something of similarity. And the more similarities there are, this is why people try to get married to somebody who's compatible with them. You know, you don't want to marry just a mirror image of yourself. That's not very interesting. But you want to marry somebody who's got enough in common with you so that there can be an exchange. I mean, I have some friends where, not very many, but I have some friends where we can understand what each other means just by talking kind of in code, or just by gestures. You don't have to communicate. This is the way Krishna communicates, of course, with his pure devotees. He communicates with his eyebrows, or moving his eyes, saying things with triple and quadruple meaning. You know, there's when Radharani and the gopis are doing the worship of the sun god, and Jatila shows up. So Krishna is saying something to Jatila that has a separate meaning for Radharani. And Jatila's understanding one thing and Radharani's understanding something else. So that's the kind of unity, you know, in Prem Samput, Radharani explains to Krishna that she and Krishna are like one soul in two bodies. That's really the only way one experiences ultimate rasa. There has to also be that unity. So everything else is a, you know, as soon as you come to the material world, you have an illusion of separateness and difference. And to whatever degree that unity is gone, to that degree, rasa is impossible. So from a relative point of view, one can say there's no rasa between man and animals. I take it just like they say there's no lust, greed, and envy in swarga. That's said in the Bhagavatam. But, you know, of course there is.
Mm-hmm.
From Krishna's point of view, there's lust and greed and envy on swarga, lots of it. From a human point of view, there isn't any. You know, if we were just to take a quick trip to swarga right now, we'd go, wow, there's no lust, greed, and envy and at all here. Everybody loves each other. And then you go, this is what happened to Gopakumar. You know, as he was going up through the planets, he kept saying, wow, this is perfect. Well, no, it's not. And then he go up a little higher. Wow, this is perfect. Oh, no, it's not. And then he goes up a little higher. And it's only when he goes to Goloka Vrindavan he finds that it's perfect. So I see like that. You know, in comparison to human rasa, there really isn't any rasa between a human and an animal. But there is some. There is some. I mean, there can even be rasa, in one sense, between a human and an inanimate object. But there's no exchange. It's one way only. So we know how much rasa is that.
Okay, that sounds right. It was just that it's funny because he does say here, there's no possibility, and also because it's one of the first things you read when you read the Bhagavatam, it's like the first statement you come across.
Yeah,
sounds like, you know,
it is interesting. Well, there's, Rudra Nenamaraj brings up this point in his book, Our Original Position, that the Shastra itself and the Acharyas, and indeed it's a common habit of all cultures and all languages, to use general absolute statements non-absolutely. That, you know, once you go into academia, you are really trained that you had better only use general statements if you really mean them as a general statement. The academics are trained to hedge everything, which, of course, Prabhupada would criticize a lot. The academics will say, I believe, maybe, in some cases, they'll avoid making absolute statements because one of the things you're trained in academia is that absolute statements are absolutely never true. So, you know, you learn to be, like, super precise in your language. And lawyers do this as well. But for most people, that's odd. Most people find that really odd. And that's not the way that we generally speak. We make sweeping statements.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen so-and-so? No, he never comes to the temple. Well, you know, he might come on Janmashtami. Oh, no, I never see him anymore. Well, you know, you might see him when you go shopping. But that's not what you mean. You mean, I don't see this person socially. You don't necessarily mean that you might never run into him on the beach. So the Shastra is the same way, and all language is the same way, as Rudra Nandamarsh points out, that this is convention to speak like that. I mean, we were having a discussion with a Madhurya Kadambini group, a study group, that Jiva Goswami makes a statement in the Bhakti Sandarbha that bhakti only comes through the devotees, that Krishna never gives bhakti directly independently of his devotees because he's neutral. And Jiva Goswami goes so far as to say it's impossible for Krishna to give bhakti because Krishna is only Satchidananda. He's only pleasurable. He can't feel any sorrow. And therefore, because he can't feel any sorrow, he can't feel the pain of the conditioned living entities. Therefore, he's not inclined to do anything to help them. He's just neutral. Now, what's interesting about that statement is that Jiva Goswami says it, as long as the translations we're looking at are correct, as an absolute statement. It's impossible for Krishna to feel sorrow and therefore material compassion And it's impossible for Krishna, who's neutral, to ever interfere in the life of a non-devotee and bring them to bhakti. However, we have a number of places that are showing the opposite. We have in Brihad Bhagavatamrita, where the Lord says to Gopakumar, I believe Lord Vishnu, when Gopakumar comes to Vaikuntha, he says that, I was waiting, he said, I was dancing like a fool, waiting life after life after life for you to turn to me, but not once did you ever chant my holy name, not once did you ever do anything for me, and I was wondering how to bring you back to me without violating my eternal laws. And finally, I broke my eternal laws, and although you didn't have the karma or the desire, I arranged for you to take birth in Govardhan. So Krishna arranged for that living entity, who had no desire in his own and no sukriti on his own, nothing, without the interference of a devotee, without the via media of a devotee, Krishna, on his own account, because he was so much caring about this jiva, Gopakumar, arranged for this jiva to take birth in Govardhan, where he got some natural agatha sukriti, and then Krishna himself became Gopakumar's guru jayanta. So there we have an example, a counterexample, to Jiva Goswami's absolute statement. We also have many statements from Srila Prabhupada that Krishna feels pain at the rebellious living entity. In fact, Prabhupada explains that the essence of our sin in being a conditioned soul is that we're giving pain to Krishna. And of course, pain to ourselves, but we're part of Krishna. So if I hurt myself, I'm naturally hurting Krishna. That's the essence of the reason why I'm in the material world. So Jiva Goswami saying Krishna can't feel any pain, but Prabhupada saying Krishna is feeling pain. Prabhupada says Krishna is feeling pain just like the parent feels pain if the child is not good. It's indirect pain, obviously, but it's still pain. So in the discussion, one of the devotees was saying that the problem is that Jiva Goswami is making an absolute statement. He's saying it's impossible for Krishna to feel pain. He never interferes. And of course, if we look at Gaura Lila, we're seeing how Vishnu Tattva, as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, not just avatar, but avatari, and as Nityananda, are actively bringing conditioned souls to bhakti without the intermediary of another devotee. Of course, you can say they're acting as a devotee, but be that as it may, they're doing it in Vishnu form. Anyway, that's just one example. I could give you many examples, but that's just one example of where we will find that an acharya is making an absolute statement, or even Shastra is making an absolute statement that's really not absolute. That's really general. That's giving a general principle, or even that one could say is a relative statement. That when we really say there's no rasa, what we really mean is compared to human relations, there's no rasa. Or if we say there's no lust in heaven, what we really mean is compared to human relations, there's no lust in heaven. I'm sure that that Srimad Bhagavatam does not mean to say that there's actually no lust in heaven. Because Indra can be a pretty lusty guy, and he's the head of heaven. So if the chief fellow in heaven can be lusty, excuse me, Indra, please don't be angry with me, then what to speak of the people who are subordinate to Indra? Even Brihaspati, the guru of Indra, now I'm going to be disturbing my Jupiter, even Brihaspati, he lusted after his brother's pregnant wife. But yet Shastra says there's no lust in heaven. So there's just so many examples of where these statements are not, that appear absolute or not absolute. So then we go to the question, well, how do we know which of the statements put in general language are actually absolutely true in all time, places, and circumstance? Keep in mind that something can be absolutely true in context and not be absolutely true in all time, places, and circumstance. There's two kinds of it's absolutely true. One is, if there's a car coming and I say, hey, there's a car coming, don't cross the street. That's an absolutely true statement. But that's not an absolutely true statement in all past, present, and future for all persons. It's not absolutely true to all persons at all time, places, and circumstances that they shouldn't cross the street. So how do we know which of the statements are always true in all time, places, and circumstances for all persons? So Bhaktivinoda Thakur compiled a list of those called the Dasmula Tattva.
Oh. Sounds interesting.
Okay, sorry to give such a long answer.
Wonderful, thank you.
Anybody else?
Hare Krishna, Mother Urmila. I maybe not very related question I have, but I still wanted to ask, because as you mentioned also today, it's a little thing, but that in Goloka Vrindavan, that God's some God is being worshipped, and sometimes I heard some devotees saying, aha, you know, you see how actually Varnashram Dharma is being kept the principles of the Varnashram Dharma is being executed in Goloka Vrindavan. Could you please explain, because I don't understand that at all, why some God is being worshipped, and is it any connection with Varnashram Dharma?
Well, this is explained in Brihad Bhagavatamrita when Gopakumar goes to Dwarka in the spiritual world, and he asks Uddhava some questions, and Uddhava tells Narada, you should answer. And his reason is, I'm a Kshatriya, Narada, you're a Brahmana, so you're better able to answer. And Narada says, why are you observing such material conventions in the spiritual world? And Uddhava says, because Krishna likes to. He likes to appear as a king. So I would say that the origin of everything, Janmadyasya Yataha, the origin of everything exists in the spiritual world.
Mm-hmm.
So there's, I mean, what to speak of in Goloka Vrindavan, there's concepts of mundane morals and ethics. The gopis have this concept that they're married to someone else and that it's immoral to go and dance with Krishna. So what meaning does that have? It's, in one sense, that's nonsensical. How is there any morals and ethics in the spiritual world? But it makes it fun. Therefore we say lila or krida. It's sport. It's play. It's not serious. It's not that there's some rules of Varnashram Dharma so that you can be happy and follow the moral rules and go to heaven. It's just their play. It's how they're playing. And in one sense, that is the absolute truth. So, what is the, I give this example many times, what is the absolute truth? That Nanda Maharaj is Krishna's father, or that Nanda Maharaj is Krishna's son? Depends whether you're looking at tattva or rasa. If you're looking at tattva, then everyone is Krishna's son, including Nanda Maharaj. If you're looking at rasa, Nanda Maharaj is Krishna's father. So you could also say, why is there a concept of father and child? There's no birth. There's no birth in the spiritual world. Where does this idea come, that this is my father, my mother? Rupa Goswami gives a whole family in Radha Krishna Ganadesh Deepika. He gives the whole description of the families of Goloka Vrindavan. You know, it's really a family. The brothers and the sisters and the aunts and the uncles and the cousins and Yasoda's side and Nandamarja's side and then Vrishabhanu's side and Kirtida's side and there's all family. They're all linked by family. Well, how does that make any sense if there's no birth? So, you know, how do you want to look at it? Do you want to look at it and say, well, actually none of that's true, and they're just assuming that position for the sake of lila? Or do you want to say Krishna's lila is the ultimate truth? Krishna's lila is the ultimate truth above, you know, ontological reality. Therefore, it is ultimately true that Nanda Maharaj is the father of Krishna. I just think about that statement for a while. If we're going to say that the ultimate, highest truth is that Nanda is the father of Krishna, boggles the mind.
Right.
You know, then Krishna isn't Krishna anymore? Is Nandamaraj God? But you can't mix those perspectives. You can't mix the tattva ontological perspective with the lila perspective. And therefore, the residents of Goloka Vrindavan, which includes Dwarka and Mathura, they're not in this mood that Krishna is God. So yeah, they're worshipping demigods. Mother Yasoda is praying to Narayan to protect Krishna. And she tells Krishna, when you go out in the forest, pray to Lord Narayan to protect you. And Krishna's trying hard to repress his smile. And Rupa Goswami says, may the repressed smile of Krishna benedict you. So, you know, the gopis, it's interesting because the gopis in their prayers when Krishna leaves the Rasalila, they say, you're not really the son of Mother Yasoda, you're really the indwelling witness within everyone's heart. So they know that. At one level, they know that, you know, even Mahaprabhu is saying, I'm not a Brahmin, I'm not a Kshatriya, I'm not of this, I'm not of that, I'm just Gopi Bharata, Kamala, Das, 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 Anu Das. So they know that, but it's not, it doesn't affect their feeling that Krishna is just this village boy who I'm in love with. It doesn't change that. Mother Yasoda sees a universal form. It doesn't change her emotional connection with Krishna as my little boy, and if I don't feed him, he's going to die. If I don't protect him, he's going to get hurt. But what to speak of something like, you know, we're cowherd girls, we're kings, we're servants. I mean, there are servants in Goloka Vrindavan. They're in the mood that I'm a servant. And Nandamaraj is thinking, I'm a cowherd man, I'm a Vaishya. So, Vedeshu Durlabham Adurlabham Atma Bhakto. You know, the with the mind, it's just neti neti. There must be just nothing, nothing, nothing. All of the things that are material and cause us so much pain, they must just not exist. And to think that they exist in a pure form, it's very difficult for us. But they do. Even in Goloka Vrindavan, unlike like in Vaikuntha, there's even sweating. You know, on Swarga, there's nobody sweats. But Mother Yasoda is sweating. In Swarga, in the material world, your clothes don't get dirty. They don't have any laundry machines in Indra's planet. Your bodies don't sweat. Your clothes don't get dirty. But Krishna's clothes get dirty. He comes back from herding the cows. He's covered with sweat and dirt. So how is that? No, but that can also be attractive. The hero covered with sweat and dirt, and the girls are swooning over the sweaty, dirty hero. That's also there. Krishna has a Dhirodhata side of his personality. The bad boy. Again, like the girls who are attracted to some guy on the back of a motorcycle. You know, who's almost a criminal. You know, almost. The outlaw who does good for the world. The bad boy. Krishna's got that side too. He's Dhiraprasanta, Dhiradatta, Dhiralalita, and he's also Dhiradatta. So how is that? And Krishna lies. He's the absolute truth, and he lies. You know, talking about Krishna playing as a cowherd boy or as a king. But he's the absolute truth, and he's telling lies. He says, Mother, I didn't eat any dirt. Or he says to Chandravali, sure, I'll come and see you. Then he turns around and goes to Radhakund. You know, so therefore we don't so much discuss those things with people in general. Of course, Srila Prabhupada was so amazing that he produced Krishna Book. Very early in his preaching, he produced Krishna Book, which we distribute to the mass of people. So how amazing is that? I just want to close by saying that one thing I've been meditating on recently, which has just been so exciting is how there's a progression. Just like Sankaracharya was preaching impersonalism, and then Ramanujacharya came to preach Vishvadvaita, then Madhvacharya came to preach dualism, finally Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to preach Achintya-bheda-bheda tattva. But I was realizing that Srila Prabhupada is actually giving a next step up, even from what Mahaprabhu gave, as the Senapati of Mahaprabhu's mission. I mean, for example, in Mahaprabhu's time, Vraj Bhakti was not brought outside of India. And there was still a lot of caste by birth consciousness, which Mahaprabhu disturbed to some extent. I mean, Mahaprabhu made Haridas Thakur the Namacharya. He had Rupa Goswami and Sanatana Goswami, who were considered fallen brahmanas. They'd become practically like Muslims. He made them write his books and be his leading preachers. And, of course, the followers of Mahaprabhu, there were many acharyas that were born in non-Brahmin families. There was the rescue of Jughai and Madhai. But we didn't find that Mahaprabhu and even his followers were making disciples, making devotees from the Mleccha Nyavana caste in large numbers. You know, there's one Haridas Thakur, there's one prostitute who surrendered to Haridas Thakur, there's one Jughai and Madhai, but not in large numbers. And then, you know, we find Rupa and Sanatan, they didn't try to go in the Jagannath Puri temple, nor did Haridas Thakur. The Prabhupada wanted his disciples to go in the Jagannath Puri temple. I was thinking of this particularly in regard to women, how Srila Prabhupada was often bragging how he was engaging women in ways that weren't even done in Mahaprabhu's time. I mean, if you want to find women fully engaged in service, you have to go all the way back to Vedic times. You've got to go back to another yuga to find women who were chanting the Vedic mantras. So Prabhupada's bringing things forward, and Prabhupada's bringing things forward to the point that he's distributing Krishna book to people on the street. So I see that things are expanding. But it's pretty amazing. I mean, to understand Krishna's Leela, how can we understand Krishna's Leela? That appears to be, it's called Nara Leela. It appears to be like that of human society. Therefore, it's very sweet. Sweeter even than Vaikuntha, with its majesty. So thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.